quite apart from the duties of parentage, perhaps 10% or more of the adult population will, at some time or other in their lives, be workers in the world's educational organization. And education, as the New Age will conceive it, will go on throughout life. It won't cease at any particular age. Men and women will simply become self-educators and individual students and student teachers as they grow older. Third, there will be no armies, no navies, and no classes of unemployed people, either wealthy or poor. Fourth, the world state's organization of scientific research and record, compared with that of today, will be like an ocean liner beside the dugout canoe of some early Heliolithic wanderer. Fifth, there'll be a vast free literature of criticism and discussion. Sixth, the world's political organization will be democratic, that's to say the government and direction of affairs will be in immediate touch with and responsive to the general thought of the educated whole population. Seventh, its economic organization will be an exploitation of all natural wealth and every fresh possibility science reveals by the agents and servants of the common government for the common good. Private enterprise will be the servant, a useful, valued, and well-rewarded servant, and no longer the robber master of the common weal. Eighth, and this implies two achievements that seem very difficult to us today. They're matters of mechanism, but they are as essential to the world's well-being as it is to a soldier's, no matter how brave he may be, that his machine gun should not jam, and to an aeronaut that his steering gear shouldn't fail him in midair. Political well-being demands that electoral methods shall be used, and economic well-being requires that a currency shall be used, safeguarded or proof against the contrivances and manipulations of clever, dishonest men. Fourth, there can be little question that the attainment of a federation of all humanity, together with a sufficient measure of social justice to ensure health, education, and a rough equality of opportunity to most of the children born into the world, would mean such a release and increase of human energy as to open a new phase in human history. The enormous waste caused by military preparation and the mutual annoyance of competing great powers, and the still more enormous waste due to the underproductiveness of great masses of people, either because they're too wealthy for stimulus or too poor for efficiency, would cease. There'd be a vast increase in the supply of human necessities, a rise in the standard of life, and in what's considered a necessity, a development of transport and every kind of convenience. And a multitude of people would be transferred from low-grade production to such higher work as art of all kinds, teaching, scientific research, and the like. All over the world, there would be a setting free of human capacity, such as has occurred hitherto only in small places and through precious limited phases of prosperity and security, unless we're to suppose that spontaneous outbreaks of supermen have occurred in the past. It's reasonable to conclude that the Athens of Pericles, the Florence of the Medici, Elizabethan England, the great deeds of Ahsoka, the Tang and Ming periods in art, are but samples of what a whole world of sustained security would yield continuously and cumulatively. Without supposing any change in human quality, but merely its release from the present system of inordinate waste, history justifies this expectation. We've seen how, since the liberation of human thought in the 15th and 16th centuries, a comparatively few curious and intelligent men, chiefly in Western Europe, have produced a vision of the world and a body of science that is now, on the material side, revolutionizing life. Mostly these men have worked against great discouragement with insufficient funds and small help or support from the mass of mankind. It's impossible to believe that these men were the maximum intellectual harvest of their generation. England alone in the last three centuries must have produced scores of Newtons who never learnt to read, hundreds of Daltons, Darwins, Bacons, and Huxleys who died stunted in hovels or never got a chance of proving their quality. All the world over, there must have been myriads of potential first-class investigators, splendid artists, creative minds who never caught a gleam of inspiration or opportunity for every one of that kind who has left his mark upon the world. In the trenches of the Western Front alone during the late war, thousands of potential great men died unfulfilled. But a world with something like a secure international peace and something like social justice will fish for capacity with the fine net of universal education and may expect a yield beyond comparison greater than any yield of able and brilliant men that the world has known hitherto. It's such considerations as this, indeed, which justify the concentration of effort in the near future upon the making of a new world state of righteousness out of our present confusions. War is a horrible thing, and constantly more horrible and dreadful, so that unless it's ended, it'll certainly end human society. Social injustice and the sight of the limited and cramped human beings it produces torment the soul. But the strongest incentive to constructive political and social work for an imaginative spirit lies not so much in the mere hope of escaping evils as in the opportunity for great adventures that their suppression will open to our race. We want to get rid of the militarist, not simply because he hurts and kills, but because he's an intolerable thick-voiced blockhead who stands hectoring and blustering in our way to achievement. We want to abolish many extravagances of private ownership, just as we would want to abolish some idiot guardian who refused us admission to a studio in which there were fine things to do. There are people who seem to imagine that a world order and one universal law of justice would end human adventure. It would but begin it. But instead of the adventure of the past, the romance of the cinematograph world, the perpetual reiterated harping upon the trite reactions of sex and combat and the hunt for gold, it would be an unending exploration upon the edge of experience. Hitherto, man has been living in a slum, amidst quarrels, revenges, vanities, shames and taints, hot desires and urgent appetites. He's scarcely tasted sweet air yet, and the great freedoms of the world that science has enlarged for him? To picture to ourselves something of the wider life that world unity would open to men is a very attractive speculation. Life will certainly go with a stronger pulse. It'll breathe a deeper breath, because it'll have dispelled and conquered 100 infections of body and mind that now reduce it to invalidism and squalor. We've already laid stress on the vast elimination of drudgery from human life through the creation of a new race of slaves, the machines. This, and the disappearance of war, and the smoothing out of endless restraints and contentions by juster social and economic arrangements, will lift the burden of toilsome work and routine work that's been the price of human security since the dawn of the first civilizations from the shoulders of our children. Which doesn't mean that they will cease to work, but that they will cease to do irksome work under pressure, and will work freely, planning, making, creating, according to their gifts and instincts. They'll fight nature no longer as dull conscripts of the pick and plough, but for a splendid conquest. Only the spiritlessness of our present depression blinds us to the clear intimations of our reason, that in the course of a few generations, every little country town could become an Athens. Every human being could be gentle in breeding and healthy in body and mind. The whole solid earth, man's mine, and its uttermost regions, his playground. In this outline, we've sought to show two great systems of development interacting in the story of human society. We've seen, growing out of that later special Neolithic culture, the Heliolithic culture in the warmer alluvial parts of the world, the great primordial civilizations, fecund systems of subjugation and obedience, vast multiplications of industrious and subservient men. We've shown the necessary relationship of these early civilizations to the early temples and to king gods and god kings. At the same time, we've traced the development from a simpler Neolithic level of the wanderer peoples who became the nomadic peoples in those great groups, the Aryans and the Hun-Mongol peoples of the northwest and the northeast, and from a Heliolithic phase, the Semites of the Arabian deserts. Our history has told of a repeated overrunning and refreshment of the original brunette civilizations by these hardier, bolder, free-spirited peoples of the steppes and desert. We've pointed out how these constantly recurring nomadic injections have steadily altered the primordial civilizations both in blood and in spirit, and how the world religions of today and what we now call democracy, the boldness of modern scientific inquiry, and a universal restlessness are due to this nomadization of civilization.